Chris Moore.
Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
All right, hour two of the radio get-together on this Sunday evening in New York. Hope your day went well. I know that if you spent the morning watching tennis, it went longer than you thought it would, and a lot of the stores in your town did worse business than they thought they would because it's what we call riveting adult drama in the big leagues. And it was certainly that this morning for Federer and Note and Djokovic. Matt Casey on the other side of the glass working alongside Pete Hoffman. They're taking care of me tonight. The phone number has not changed, 877-337-6666. And later in the hour, we will, in fact, take your calls. We'll also talk to Anthony McCarron later in the program as well, a little baseball with him. Trading deadline now 17 days away, but nice enough to join us on this Sunday night. Our friend John Feinstein, who tweeted out, among other things, and I thought it was interesting because he is such a wordsmith that even he, even he was struggling for the right words. And John, I opened the show tonight saying that I couldn't do it justice and that if you're a non-sports fan, trying to explain how riveting and how impressive and how gripping that match was is almost, I don't know if it can be done in words, but trying to explain how that match grabbed you is really a hard thing to do. But I'm telling you, people were riveted to it is the only way I can describe it.
I don't know if you started watching it at any point along the way. As you said, it started a little after 9 in the morning, and at our time, it didn't end until after 2 o'clock. Our time, which was after 7 in London. Riveting is a very good word. There are many other words you can use, and I guess the point I was making in my tweet, and I wrote a CBS Minute for tomorrow, which I said basically the same thing. You can use up all the words, all the adjectives, all the superlatives, and I'm not sure you would properly describe how remarkable this day was at Wimbledon, and of course it's the most iconic place in tennis. It's the most important championship. You have, I would say, you could pick your order. You can debate that later. But two of the three best players of all time, Nadal being the third one in the conversation, playing at the top of their games, each wanting desperately to win for different reasons. Federer, as amazing as he is, 25 days short of 38. Knows the clock is ticking, knows his chances to get to these finals is going to be limited. And Djokovic very much wants to equal Federer, surpass Nadal, surpass Federer if he can before he's done. And he's the kind of competitor who I think likes, I'm not sure likes is the right word, but he feeds off of the crowd's negative energy. It's not like they were booing him or anything, but there's no question the crowd was for Federer, which isn't surprising. Again, he's almost 38. He's been a class act his whole career. But I thought one of the cooler things, I don't know if you noticed this, when they went to the tiebreak in the fifth set, first time in history, fifth set tiebreaker at Wimbledon at 12-all, McEnroe, and Fowler basically just shut up. And they talked very little during that tiebreak. They let the tennis speak for itself. And as you know, rarely does television do that. And I thought it was exactly the right thing to do. I don't know about you. I've been around a long time. I'm pretty jaded. But I had chills watching the end of that. I really did.
Yeah, I had to stand up at times. You know, I had to stand up. Yeah. I couldn't sit in my chair. And I didn't really care who won that. I mean, it really wasn't invested.
I didn't want either to lose.
Exactly
the way
right.
I would put
exactly
it.
Exactly.
They're both such good guys and yep. great players. And my wife walked in here because when they were presenting the trophies, I'm sitting in here in my office alone. Well, there was a cat here, but basically alone. And I'm applauding.
Yeah.
And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I can't help myself. This deserves applause, even if nobody's listening but the cat."
No, and you're right. I mean, I did tweet out what you just said was that it just sucks that somebody has to lose this match, you know, and that was like the fourth set, and I thought, this just, I mean, it's just too good. And the other great thing, John, that I thought was notable here is that how often do you get players who have been in so many big matches before that you know neither one of them is going to choke. Yeah, there's right. an unbelievable amount of pressure, but both of them have been through this before. They're in their 30s. They shouldn't even be around anymore. Where's the Boris? I mean, where's the Boris Becker? Where's the next guy coming up who's 19-year-old phenom to knock them off? And here they are just, you know, battling and have done it a million times before. So you're not going to get any quit. You're not going to get any whining. You're not going to get any choking. You're going to get whatever you get. Just buckle up and enjoy it. And I thought that was, you know, really notable as well.
Well, you know, one of the best tennis writers of my lifetime was a guy named Barry Lorge, who I idolized when I was a kid and then got to work with at the Washington Post and eventually succeeded him as the tennis writer at the Post, which is sort of like, you know, following John Wooden at UCLA. And Barry used to always say that a truly great tennis match was like a heavyweight fight, a great heavyweight fight. Punch after punch, guys, knock down, get up, knock the other guy down. This was like the 15th round of Rocky, you know, and they just kept slugging each other, and you were like, wait a minute, they have to go down. There's no way they can continue to take this pounding, and they kept pounding at one another, and each guy just kept getting up, and finally Djokovic got the last punch in, and really until match point, when Federer mishit that forehand, you know, went straight up in the air, I don't think there was an unforced error in a tiebreak. I mean, at every point was a winner.
Yeah.
And they've been playing almost 5 hours, Chris.
Oh, man.
They're still slamming winners, and they're spinning in really hard to return second serves when they missed a first serve. And, you know, it used to be in the old days that if you couldn't get your first serve in late or in a tiebreak, whatever, you're going to lose. And these guys, when they missed the first serve, the second serve was almost as good as the first. And, of course, the returns were great because they're both brilliant returners.
Now, you're smarter than most, so I'll give you that. I'll give you that credit up front. But how many times, and I brought this up with the audience earlier, how many times in the match, and this is part of why sports is so hard to explain to people who don't get it. How many times in that match did you think, oh, he's done now. Oh, that was a big mistake. He's not going to survive that. Oh, momentum's all with Djokovic now. Oh, momentum's back with – I mean, you're sitting there – and you are sure that something is going to happen. And you never seem to learn, kind of like the weatherman, you never learn that you don't know and you're not going to know. And just when you think it's not going to happen. But that's part of the emotion of watching it. It's why it's so memorable, is that you're so invested in what's going to happen next. I can't explain it.
Yeah, no. Well, you did a good job there, but because that's what makes sports at its best. So great. And by the way, weathermen and bracketologists, because they change their stories every couple hours. But you're right, because like when Djokovic wins that third set tiebreak, you're thinking, oh, how much does Federer have left?
Exactly.
You know, he's playing a great player. Now he's down 2-1, and he comes back and wins the fourth set. And then Federer breaks Djokovic. And, oh, my God, Federer, who serves as well as anybody in the world, then he's up 40-15.
Yes. And you're standing.
Great returns.
You're standing up. You can't sit down anymore. I'm standing up watching those.
You're waiting to give them the standing ovation
exactly.
they both deserve after Federer wins.
Exactly. And before that game, I think Federer had a running volley that he'd make 50 times out of 50, and he blew it, and he had a chance to break him earlier, and then the next point was deuce, and then, you know, Djokovic eventually holds, and you're like, wow, that was his chance right there. He had that one, and he blew it, and now, you know, he's not going to be able to come back. And, of course, you know, he kicked that aside as well, and we got all the way to the tiebreaker, and
we know what
happened.
Well, that gets back to your point about how many finals these guys have played and how they understand that, you know, okay, I blew my chance to break there, but I'm going to get another chance because I know how good I am. And they're both brilliant players. They're great competitors. I saw a couple people criticizing Djokovic for eating the grass after he won.
Right.
That's what he does.
Yeah.
When he wins Wimbledon.
Yeah.
And it's a tribute to the grass courts. It's not like being a jerk. Djokovic is anything but a jerk. I mean, I cover tennis. I haven't covered tennis regularly for a while, but one of the reasons I don't cover it regularly is because when I covered the sport, it was so hard to get access to players, and some of them were such jerks. And we are now in an era where these guys, I would say, are without the only other player who might be in their class for greatest of all time is Rod Laver. Labor won 11 majors, but missed 5 years at the peak of his career because of stupid tennis rules that wouldn't let pros play in Grand Slams. And most players, anybody who saw him would tell you that nobody was better. So the three of them and Labor are probably, you know, they're Mount Rushmore. And a lot of people in this country are missing what is the greatest golden era in the history of tennis because there are no Americans.
Right.
You know, we're all looking for McEnroe or Connors or Agassi or Sampras.
None like Coco.
And there's none on the horizon.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You know, Francis Tiafoe gets to the quarterfinals of the Australian Open, and you'd have thought he won two Grand Slams.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
Because it's been so long since we've had, you know, an American who was a serious contender. I mean, Chris, it's unbelievable. Assuming no American wins the U.S. Open, it'll been 16 years. Since Andy Roddick won the Open in 2003.
Yeah.
16 years.
And as you said, the horizon looks very slim. And the other interesting point that you brought up a little bit, but we need to expound upon, is just how classy and sportsmanship level in 2019, where our politicians embarrass us, where our public figures embarrass us, where our social media embarrass. I mean, we just don't have very many role models to tell our kids, hey, you know, handle it like them.
Watch how he does it.
And yeah, right. Exactly. And boy, are these guys, watch how he does it, guys. I mean, all three of them.
Yeah. I mean, you got to put Nadal in that conversation, too. They genuinely like and respect one another. You know, when Nadal walked over to Sue Barker for that on-court interview, you could tell all he wanted to do was get the hell out of there.
Yep.
And understandably. And I loved his first comment when Sue Barker said, and this is a memory we'll take with us the rest of our lives. And he said, I'm going to try to forget it. I thought that was very funny. And they were both gracious to one another, and they always are. And I thought one thing that a lot of people missed, when Djokovic won match point, he didn't fall on his back. He didn't throw his arms in the air. He just walked to net and shook hands. And I think that was out of respect for Federer. Because he knew how much it hurt Federer to lose, because he knew how much it would hurt him to lose. And I thought that in its own way was a cool moment, that kind of show of respect for Federer from Djokovic.
Yeah.
They are class acts. They absolutely are.
And I think they both believed, and I don't mean publicly, I mean in their hearts, that it's a shame someone had to lose this match.
I think
they believed it. And that's the part of it that I think they get so well. And the other part they get so well that we seem to have a problem with is that when you have a winner, you're going to have a loser. It might be me today. And if it's me, I'm going to handle it with class. And that's those guys seem to bring that every time. They understand that in order for someone to win, someone has to lose. And that may seem elementary, but it's amazing to me how often I get the sense that they don't get it, that, you know, if there's a winner, there better be a loser. It's got to be an opposite
side.
Well,
and it's funny because this is the 10th anniversary last week. Was the 10th anniversary of Tom Watson coming within inches of winning the British Open at the age of 59.
Yeah.
And I wrote a column about Tom last week, and I talked to him on the phone, and I said, when did you get over it? And he said, the next day, John. And I said, really? And he said, look, I've won a lot. I've lost a lot. I know what it meant to Stuart Sink to win. It's the only major Stuart Sink's ever won. Tom's won 8. And you lose, you're disappointed, you might second-guess yourself, you what-if a few shots, but you understand that losing is a part of being a great competitor. And the greatest competitors, and again, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, you pick your order, they're, along with Laver, they're Mount Rushmore. The greatest competitors, because they have lost, they have empathy for the other guy when they win.
Yeah, that makes sense, and yet so often we don't see it. We got 90 seconds. Give me Port Rush and your thoughts about what will happen.
You know, it's so much at the British Open is about the weather, and you just don't know what you're going to get. I played Port Rush like 30 years ago when I could still play a little bit. It is a great golf course, and I don't know exactly how the R&L set it up, but they always do a very good job. The best story, and I'm biased here, would be Rory McIlroy winning in Northern Ireland. And he's had an amazing year. He's played incredibly consistent golf. He played fine at the Scottish Open this week. Not great, but fine. And I think he's coming in on good form. The question will be, will the pressure playing in front of the hometown fans get to him, or will it help him? Because if he could win, it would be a great story. And, of course, Brooks Koepka has been so unbelievable. And, of course, everybody's going to say Tiger, Tiger, Tiger. Fine, if Tiger contends, you know, I know that'll be the story. I would rather see it be Rory McIlroy versus Brooks Koepka coming down the stretch next Sunday.
John, appreciate it as always. Thanks for giving us a few minutes. It was riveting today. Great stuff, and it was nice to talk to you about it. Thanks.
I was riveting? Wow.
Even you were riveting. You know, I mean,
I was riveted. I'm with you, pal. Good to talk to you.
All right, John. Be good.
Thanks.
John Feinstein joining us to talk Wimbledon and obviously British Open this week. Portrush on Thursday will be round one of that major tournament, and we look forward to that. And that's the end of it this year because the PGA moved to May, so this is the final major instead of where it normally is the next to last major, but they changed the PGA calendar. So this is it until the FedEx Cup.